Hello, welcome to another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong, speaking to you from here in Istanbul. Many thanks for tuning in. In this podcast, we hear from authors of newly released books on Turkey and the region. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, or Acast. Like the Facebook page, follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. Check out show notes and other links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com and rate or review the podcast on whatever platform you listen on. Remember to consider joining as a member to help support Turkey Book Talk. Membership gives you various extra benefits and content. Paying members get access to a range of extra things, including full transcripts in both English and Turkish of every interview published on Turkey Book Talk in PDF form as soon as the episode is published. Members also receive transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive, which so far amounts to over 60 conversations. Most of these transcripts were previously published at the Hurriyet Daily News, but nowadays a Turkey Book Talk membership is the only way to access them. The archive also includes a number of interviews not previously published on the podcast. Members also get access to a special 30% discount on Turkey Ottoman history books published by IB Taurus. IB Taurus have a terrific archive of titles and they've made over 200 books from their Turkey Ottoman history series, both academic and general interest, available at cut price, exclusive to Turkey Book Talk members, through a special discount code. A number of IB Taurus authors have appeared on the podcast in the past and there will be more in the future, so becoming a member is a great way to get more acquainted with their work. If you do become a member, you'll be helping us develop the podcast, and if more people join, we may end up being able to start publishing a new episode every week, up from the current one episode every 2 weeks. To become a member, just pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account, which you can find via a link at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com or via any of the other podcast pages. At present, we post new episodes every 2 weeks, so the monthly membership price is no more than $6. If we end up being able to publish a new episode every week, then that will go up to $12 monthly maximum. Of course, if you're feeling particularly generous and want to pledge more, then you'll certainly be more than welcome. But so long as you pledge $3 or above per episode, membership is entirely at your own discretion. Members are only charged when a new episode is published, so there are no prior commitments or strings attached. You'll be free to sign off whenever you want. But now on with our latest episode. In it, we welcome Jonathan Vajabedian. He is one of the editors of a remarkable book called My Dear Son Garabad, Kocayan Family Letters from Efkere Kayseri to America, 1912 to 1919, which is published by Histor Press. The book is a collection of 88 letters written and sent between the years of 1912 and 1919, mostly between 1912 and 1915. They were found in a box over 15 years ago, and they were all penned by members of the Kocayan family, written in the Armenian script and using a highly dialectical form of Turkish. Born in the 1890s in Efkere, a village northeast of Kayseri, which is in today's Turkey, Garabad emigrated to the United States as a young man, one of the many Ottoman Armenians crossing the Atlantic in the years before the First World War. He was followed by his father Harutyan in 1913, and the letters found in the box were written and sent by family members and neighbours they left behind in Efkere. The letters give us the only documentation of the Efkere Armenian dialect, and they describe local village events, gossip, births, deaths, illnesses, and miscellaneous family news. What emerges is a unique portrait of Ottoman village life in the years before the catastrophe of 1915, when the Armenians were wiped out of Efkere, and after which the village itself would end up abandoned. We talk about the character of the letters and what they tell us later in the conversation, but I started by asking Jonathan Vajabedian, who's the grandson of Garabed Kocayan, how they discovered the letters in the first place.
The letters were essentially rediscovered around the year 2000. My grandfather, Garabed Kocayan, died in 1976, and he was a man that never really discussed his upbringing with his children. We knew that he had been born and raised in a village called Efkere. We knew he came to Detroit in 1912. His father came a year later, but he never spoke to his children about the life that he left behind in Turkey. So when he died in 1976 in suburban Detroit, it got a lot of the family asking questions about what is the history of this man, of his family, and wanting to know more, but there was really nothing to go on. My mother would often tell me that she would remember as a girl, Garabed and his father, Harutyun Kocayan, going into a room late at night and rereading a packet of letters that they received from the old country and just crying. Nobody knew who these letters were from, but in my mind, it was a fascinating story. And then around the year 2000, my aunt, Marjorie Kudryan Ossian, discovered this tin box, and in it contained maybe 250 letters altogether. Nobody knew what was written in the letters. Nobody in the family was able to read Armenian, and she entrusted the letters to me, and I began the process of trying to get these letters translated. That was a difficult process. I took it to several Armenians in the local community. At the time, I was living in the Detroit area, and they recognized that the letters were written with the Armenian alphabet, but that it was the Turkish language that was being employed. So I then went about seeking individuals that were fluent in Armenian and Turkish. So I sought out translators all over the world, in Canada, in Turkey, in Armenia, in Australia, in the US, and they were able to hesitatingly translate very, very small portions of the letters. But they would always just, they would always respond to me that this must be a difficult dialect because I can't make heads or tails of it. I ended up posting information about the letters online. And that's how I came in contact with Shukru Ilacak, who was at the time studying at Harvard University. He was ideally suited for this task, not only because he was fluent in Turkish, he's Turkish, born and raised in Ankara, but he was also fluent in Armenian. He's also fluent in Greek. He's fluent in Hebrew. And the Turkish that he's particularly interested in was the spoken Turkish of Kayseri in the 1910s. So I couldn't imagine someone more ideally suited for this task of translating these letters. And Ilacak, for which I will always be grateful, approached the letters with absolute care and respect, and he slowly translated these. And then we discovered that the letters were written from Garabed's family in Efkede. So there was page after page after page written from his mother, Hagenush Kojayan, to Garabed in Detroit. There were letters from his father, Harachun Kojayan, from his brother, Misak. And this was a family that we knew very, very little about. There were letters discussing Garabed's baby sister. We never even knew he had a baby sister. There were letters from other villagers discussing village situations. And so slowly, this entire world opened up to us, and we were able to learn about Garabed's family, my grandfather's family.
You mentioned there the language. It's very interesting that basically these letters were written in Turkish, but they were using the Armenian script. Do you have any idea how common that was for the time and place? I suppose also what kind of specific problems did it throw up for Shukru Ilacak, the translator of the letters?
The letters were written in what's called Armeno-Turkish, Turkish language, using the Armenian letters. And this was not uncommon at all. I think it's something that we often forget, but it was fairly common. Between the early 18th century and the 1950s, there were at least a couple thousand books that were published in Armeno-Turkish. Bibles, books on the arts, the sciences. There were dictionaries published as well. Interestingly, the Armenian alphabet seems well suited for the Turkish language. And there are even instances of Turkish intelligentsia, of Turkish academics using the Armenian alphabet to express themselves in the Turkish language. So I think it's something that that is frequently forgotten today, but it was fairly common. Also, it was fairly common in many parts of the Ottoman Empire, in many parts of Anatolia, for Armenians to use Turkish as their primary language, as their mother tongue. This collection of letters is particularly interesting because while the vast majority of it is written in Armeno-Turkish, Armenian letters being used to express Turkish words, there are also a handful of passages that are actually written in Armenian, and this is the Armenian dialect of this village of Efkede, which is now extinct. So I think this will be a very interesting read for the Turkish reader, for someone who is fluent in Turkish, because the letters are written in this conversational style of Kayseri in the 1910s. Each letter is presented in both a transliteration of the letter and then a translation into English. But Armeno-Turkish was fairly common.
I mean, these letters really are absolutely remarkable. I mean, it's just gives a fascinating window into very ordinary village life. That's really what struck me as being most remarkable, the kind of unremarkableness of them in a way. They're all focused really on very prosaic, very day-to-day village family issues. They use these kind of phrases, stock phrases, formal phrases, even though they're family members. It all feels very natural. And, you know, there are almost no references really to any political or ethnic issues or tensions, which is remarkable considering the time that they were written, but that makes it also feel very natural. I don't know, that feeling of unforced, intimate naturalness really does come through in these letters, I think.
And it's so remarkable because when we think back on this time period, 1912 to 1915, this was such a pivotal time period in the history of the Turkish and the Armenian peoples. And yet the letters barely hint at that. The letters are more concerned about births and deaths and illness and the price of yard goods, the price of wheat. And they are, just like you expressed so eloquently, they're remarkable for being unremarkable, essentially, for just talking about day-to-day life. And I think that's just particularly fascinating. We can look back now with the benefit of hindsight and say, something's up, especially towards the latter letters where the matriarch of the family, Hayganush Kocayan, is talking about the soldiers, the 5,000 soldiers in Kayseri. When some of the letters discuss, there was an orator in Kayseri raising money for the war. And yet, by and large, what we're left with is just a loving mother writing to her son and to her husband, a loving mother left behind in central Anatolia, writing to her husband and son in America. It expresses very, rather than these big global issues going on, it's endearing because it expresses just these universal emotions of love and of just getting by, of just going about the business of living.
And Efkare, at the time, it was an Armenian majority village. I mean, what was the population? There were Turkish families as well there, but...
There were. Sources vary, but by the time these letters were written, this era, it had approximately 500 Armenian families and 50 Turkish families. It cannot be described purely as an Armenian village, although it was an important village to the Armenians. It was the site of an important monastery for the Armenians called St. John the Baptist Monastery or Surp Garbet Vank. So Armenians held this village in a certain regard, and on feast days, the population of this village could swell by the thousands. And yet the Armenians did, in this village, live side by side with the Turkish population. There's an interesting letter from the patriarch of the family, Harchun Kocayan, to his son in 1912, describing a cholera epidemic. And he describes some of the people that died during this cholera epidemic. 30 people died, including 8 people among the Muslims. It is not purely Armenian, it is not purely Turkish, but it is an example of Armenians and Turks living side by side.
And the Garabat and Harutyun moved to America at a time when there was actually quite a lot of migration. There was a huge wave, really, of Armenians from Anatolia moving to America, leaving family behind, but still corresponding in the way that we see in these letters. And that really went on in the years before the First World War. So in a way, you can kind of see Garabat and Harutyun and the Kocayan family in these letters as kind of exemplary of an era, really. These years just before the First World War, of course, leading up to what was going to be a huge cataclysm, really. It makes it very poignant, I think.
And I think it's very interesting, too, because Harchun Kocayan writes to his son Garabet in Detroit. Garabet came to Detroit in 1912. Harchun would follow in 1913. But he writes to Garabet, and his letters do tend to stress immigration. So he will frequently talk about this villager's leaving, this villager's leaving, this villager's leaving. They're all going to America. Discuss his own desire to come to America and what he goes through to achieve that end. Going to Talas, seeing an eye doctor because he knows that that's crucial, taking some eye drops for his eyes to clear. I think you're absolutely right. This is one family in central Anatolia, and yet I think it speaks for so many other similar families. At the time, Anatolia was going through some real economic problems there. So it was not uncommon for villagers in Efkere to leave the village frequently in the spring, travel to other cities in Anatolia, such as Istanbul, earning money, and then coming back in the fall. Some did also travel to the United States, particularly for the people from Efkere, it would be New York or Detroit. Some would return before 1915. Many did not. The letters describe how grateful Garabet's mother and father are in Efkere when Garabet sends them money. You could tell that financial concerns are very significant, and it's clear that the amount of money that was earned in the United States was so great that it could really be extremely beneficial for this family in Efkere.
And what work exactly were they doing in the US? Because I don't know, it's not really referenced directly, but no. They obviously found work there.
It's not referenced directly, and it's a bit of a question mark as well. In one of the letters, Garabet's mother, Hayganush, mentions foundry work. It would seem likely to me that they came to Detroit because of the automotive industry, which was just really taking off at the time. But it's not clear, and I can't give you the answer to that even at this time.
And they sent money back practically how? By wire or?
I don't have the answer for that either. I can tell you that in some cases, the money was sent back with somebody. There's a reference to that. But I don't know how the money made it back to the Ottoman Empire. It's interesting that the money was sent not just for the family, but the village was also raising funds for the girls' school. Efkadet had a boys' school and a girls' school for a long, long time. And they wanted to, the villagers wanted to greatly improve the girls' school in the village. And they asked for villagers in America to send money to raise funds for this. And there's a nice letter in there discussing how grateful the villagers were that Garbet and Hartun, as well as other people from Efkadet in the diaspora in the United States, were willing to send money to complete the girls' school in the village.
And was there any idea, I mean, in the long run, were they thinking that they would come back or would the rest of the family eventually join them in America? Or because there's a sense that you get through the letters that everybody's kind of desperate to leave the village and they're kind of looking up to Garabed and Harutian as being, you know, as having flown the nest and they want to be next. But it's not ever again made kind of explicit.
I don't know, though, that Hartun and Garbed's plan was to leave Efkadet and not return. There's a recurring topic throughout the letters that the family wished to purchase an orchard in the Efkadet area. By reading the letters over and over again, yes, there are one or two instances where Haigenush toys with the idea of joining her husband and son in America, and where Garbed's brother Misak discusses, when I come to America, I will have learned English already. But Haigenush will later say, I'm going to stay right where I am. And there's this recurring theme of let's buy an orchard in the village. And it would seem that the goal here is for Garbed and Hartun to go to America, raise money, and come back to Efkadet. That's my general impression of the letters.
And on a practical level as well, I mean, I was found myself wondering like, how they sent these letters, because there seems to be quite a relatively quick delivery. You know, they write and then within a couple of weeks, they've reached the America. It's quite a quick turnaround. Do you have any idea about why, if it was common for such a fast delivery or?
In some cases, longer, though. When they wrote from Detroit to Efkadet, look at the dates the letters were written and the dates that are mentioned. Sometimes it could take 3 or 4 weeks for a letter to arrive. I don't know. I can't speak to that. I think it's amazing that the letters kept coming even when the situation in Anatolia was deteriorating. The final letter that we have before Haigenush and her family perished, the final letter we have is from May of 1915. This is really well into the relations between the Turkish and the Armenian peoples had really by this time deteriorated quite a bit. The Armenian intelligentsia in Istanbul had been arrested in April. So the fact that a letter comes out of Efkadet in May of 1915 and makes it to America, to me, is just fascinating. It's unbelievable.
Yes, it's incredible. I mean, in those months leading up to the summer of 1915, there's barely a hint of any trouble. It's remarkable and rather eerie, actually, because the letters, as you mentioned, that they kind of abruptly break off there in 1915. But leading up to then, there's no real hint. But as I understand it, most of the family were killed along with most of the Armenians in Efkere that year and in the following year. So from a few thousand Armenians living in Efkere before the war, just 60 remained when data was next compiled in 1924. Do we know the circumstances in which the family specifically were massacred or?
Well, let me speak to that. First, mention that this final letter from May of 1915 that arrives from Haigenush, from the matriarch of the family in Efkadet, arrives to Detroit. It's interesting to me that this is the one letter in the collection that is just worn out with wear. It's been read so many times, you can just see that the letter is actually worn out. Now, again, hindsight is 20/20, but it can also be very misleading. But I think that last letter from May 11th, 1915, it's unbelievable to me because there is no mention made of what occurred, of what is occurring in Anatolia. And yet it's a heartbreaking letter. I'm going to just read one paragraph for you, if that's okay.
Yes.
Haigenush writes to her son, Garabed, my two eyes, the light of my eye, my dear son, Garabed Kujayan. She writes, you wanted the news of your cousin, Sahag. He paid 44 liras for the beetle. This is the military, the Armenians would pay money to be exempted from military service.
Bedel, yes.
A bedel. Thank you so much. I need to learn Turkish. Misak Aga Seferian also paid the bedel, but he paid 80 liras. Bogos Aga Kanayan paid three times that amount. Setrak Kojayan did the same, and the entire village was like that. Many households were devastated, but all of this is nothing. All of this is nothing as long as God spares us death. Now, it's interesting. I think sometimes reading the letter now, it just takes on a certain added significance because it is the last letter from Haganush. But there is certainly a sadness in that letter that we don't find in the early letters. And a lot of her latter letters do talk about the deterioration of the situation in the village. As far as what happened to the family, I will say that this was something that was absolutely never discussed with my grandfather, and his father never discussed this with their children. We included two letters in this collection from 1919 because these letters allow the reader to understand exactly what, give the reader a sense of what happened. It would be great to be able to discuss this book without delving into 1915 and all that entailed, but without acknowledging what occurred in 1915, the letters lose some of their significance as well. But suffice it to say, there were deportations, there were massacres, and we're going to leave it at that for right now. There is a letter from 1919 from a Setrak Kojayan, and he tells Harutyun the fate of the family this way. He describes that his own family was sent from Efkeda to Elbistan. Elbistan was about 150 miles from Efkeda, and he tells him on June 1st, 1919, "We understand that your family went to Elbistan together with ours. After staying there for a month, they were sent towards Urfa. Now you have no one left." And that's it. That one sentence is what we have. May God give you patience. So I can't tell you the exact fate. I can tell you that we know no more of Haganush and her son Misak, but we have to assume that they died during this period. There was a small child, probably 3 years old at the time, the baby sister Berkene. I would have to assume that she died at the same time as well, but there's always the possibility, as there are other examples, that the child was taken in by a compassionate, friendly Turkish family and raised as a Turk, even. So there's always that possibility. We don't have the specific information. Your family died at this point in this manner. That's just an unknown for us.
And today, Efkere is one of the kind of many abandoned villages kind of dotted around Anatolia, are basically just kind of crumbling into ruins as the years pass. And you yourself have visited a number of times, and over the last few years you've been busy creating a website. I'll put the link up on our website. It's called efkere.com. And it's really a fascinating treasure trove of information and photos, historical and modern, basically kind of documenting the history of Efkere, this crumbling village. It's really an invaluable resource. Could you just talk a little about your efforts in this direction, about the website?
Well, I appreciate that very much. I started this website in 2001, so it's been online for quite a while right now. When I started the website, it was extremely difficult to find any information on this ancestral village of mine. Extremely difficult. So I wanted to document all that I could document, and that's how efkere.com came about. I am grateful because I've had input from Armenians and from Turks all around the world who have really provided me with information and with photographs and artifacts from the village. The village itself no longer officially exists. In the 1960s, it was incorporated into the neighboring village of Gesi. And William, you're going to have to help me out with my pronunciation, but it's now referred to as the Bahçeli. How do I say garden district?
Bahçeli. Bahçeli.
Bahçeli, thank you. District of Gesi. It exists. The primary church in the village exists, although the dome is missing. It's in a crumbling state. Most of the homes are gone. The boys and the girls' schools are gone. There was a huge sprawling monastery, which is now little more than rubble. And yet, it does exist. And it's fascinating to go to the village because it's like really walking back in time. I haven't been there for many, many years, but I do hope to go back soon.
That was Jonathan Vajabedian. Many thanks to him. And if you want to delve a bit deeper, then do check out the website that we mentioned in the conversation, fkere.com, that's E-F-K-E-R-E.com, where Jonathan is piecing together all kinds of lost historical details about the village. Remember to consider supporting Turkey Book Talk by joining as a member. All you have to do is pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Patreon, which gives you access to transcripts in English and Turkish of every episode as it's published, as well as the entire Turkey Book Talk archive of over 60 conversations so far. You also get exclusive access to a special 30% discount on over 200 books on Turkey and Ottoman history published by IB Taurus. As a member, you'll be helping Turkey Book Talk keep the show on the road, developing further and providing a bigger platform for our guests and their work. And if we get enough members, we may be able to start publishing a new episode every week. Find links to the Patreon account in order to sign up via all the Turkey Book Talk websites. And many thanks to all current members. It's very much appreciated. Also, do please rate or review Turkey Book Talk on whatever podcast platform you listen on. You can follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay fully updated with new episodes. And you can send any recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until the next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening.